Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording this on March 16th, 2017, and you're listening to episode 24. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you found this podcast, and follow us on Facebook or Twitter where we're at PoliticoastPod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian.
It looks like Garrett's going to be stuck in the political wilderness for a while.
Well, and it couldn't have happened to much worse of a person. I guess wacky hair and a hatred of Muslims is not enough to win over most of the Dutch. In other news, we're excited to announce that we're going to be partnering with the Dark Horse Report. This is a local political blog written by Vancouver blogger Braden McMillan. The site aims to make Canadian politics simple and more engaging by providing interesting articles as well as current and historical election polling. The Dark Horse Report will now also share and publish all new podcasts by Politicoast and link to them on his website and in his newsletter. And you can find the Dark Horse Report at thedarkhorse.report.
There you'll also find Braden's own BC election poll and projection based on the latest polls.
He updated that yesterday with data from Main Street / Post Media's latest poll. Right now, the BC NDP is at 39%, the Liberals at 35%, the Greens at 13%, and the Conservatives also at 13%. For our first segment today, changing the rules of the game. In the last couple of weeks, the federal government released a report on modernizing the rules of Parliament and essentially looking at the nitty-gritty of how bills become law and how the rules of the game essentially are set. This gets very deep into the weeds, but it's something that the opposition parties all criticize the Harper government very heavily for having very partisan, bickering, useless committees, for using time allocation, for famously proroguing Parliament to avoid a non-confidence vote. So this is their sort of way of going, we can do better. But the question is, are they?
This isn't the first time they've tried to change the rules of Parliament either. Got overshadowed by Elbowgate, but right around the same time, they were looking at significantly scaling back the opposition's ability to influence the legislative process with motion sits. They since backed off on this, and this is kind of their round two at trying to tweak how Parliament works.
Yeah, motion six was a very abrupt sort of change. It was basically meant to rush through the assisted dying law because there was a Supreme Court of Canada deadline that if there was no new law in place by a certain date, the Supreme Court's ruling would be law for the land. And so the government wanted its own regulations for assisted dying. But the opposition parties were saying the bill the Liberals put forward wasn't constitutional, and so they wanted to try to make sure it was the best law possible. And that led tempers to rise. This report is the, I think, better way to do it. It's a bit more consultative and sort of pitching some ideas while also looking at what else is being done in, say, Britain, the US, or Australia, or other parliaments and other legislative bodies, and how do they get shit done.
It's definitely a better approach than just announcing what you're going to do and try and pass that.
So digging into it, it's basically broken down into three major sections. The first is focused on the management of the House of Commons itself. And in there, they have some of the biggest sort of proposals. They talk about ending Friday sittings entirely. The idea being that MPs could get back to their constituencies for weekends, or MPs with young children could spend more time with them, or just not everything a parliamentarian does is in Parliament. And so it gives them a bit more time for that. This one gets a bit controversial because the Conservatives go, well, they're not showing up for work. And even in the 2011 election, Jack Layton even said to Michael Ignatieff, you're not showing up to work, because he missed a lot of votes.
Well, not only that, also in the US, this has been cited as one of the causes of increased polarization among American politicians. Back in the 90s, they had Friday sittings there and reduced it to a four-day week, similar to what's being proposed here. And that led to congressmen basically living in their home districts and commuting in for the legislative time rather than moving them and their families to D.C. And that decreased the sort of communal aspects outside of work and kind of the social network that emerged between different parties. I'm not sure how much that's been the driver of it compared to just a contributor, but it is something to be concerned about, I think, too, is will this lead to a similar sort of thing up here?
Well, the report itself cites the fact that most provinces and most provincial legislatures in Canada don't have Friday sittings, so it's in theory possible that you can have a legislature that only sits 4 days a week and still functions healthily. The corresponding proposal to this is, of course, that they would increase the calendar of days they would sit, or at least make it a little bit more flexible, because if you suddenly cut 20% of your days in Parliament off, you need to make up that time if you want to get the same number of bills through. So they are suggesting maybe they start a little earlier in January or go a little later in June, or maybe they make it open to MPs if they wanted to stay late and keep debating issues. Once you start getting into those, though, you kind of break down that, oh, we're making it easier for people to get back to their families or their constituencies, because then you're like, well, now you have to stay in Ottawa more, or if you're staying later, you can't get back to your family. So it's a trade-off, and I don't know if it's the right one.
Parliament already takes long periods of time off between sittings, so there's definitely, I think, an argument to be made that you shouldn't reduce that even further. I do like the idea of kind of playing around with how it's allocated, but I'm not sure trying to reduce that would lead to any better. So I definitely think if you are going to cut Friday sit-ins off, you definitely need to make it up elsewhere. And it might be a better idea to say go for 2 weeks of sittings followed by a week off or something and kind of spread it out more over the entire year rather than batching it in sittings followed by long breaks.
Just as long as they don't use the British Columbia model of canceling entire sessions and then just having like arbitrary emergency sessions in the middle of the summer to pass a bill that the Liberals have decided is suddenly urgent. Something I think that is hopefully less controversial, though, is they want to bring in electronic voting. And we were quite dismissive of the idea of electronic and online voting for general elections, but for MP votes, having to have them come into Parliament and record either a paper or a hand ballot for every vote can be quite onerous and can be quite time-consuming, especially because they have to ring all the right bells and there's all this pomp and circumstance. If they can just do a quick little click, which has been done in other legislatures, you can really bring this through much faster. And this is something that's been recommended since the mid-80s, and so it's not a new idea.
Yeah, no, this is just a great idea, I think. It speeds things up, and you don't really get the same drawbacks that you do for online voting with, say, a general election, where you also have to keep ballots secret, for example, or it's harder to track to make sure that there's no errors in the system. Here, every MP's vote's recorded anyway, it's a matter of public record, so it's you don't have that secrecy aspect that makes it really hard to make a digital system that's both accountable and anonymous. And as the report mentioned, since they're going to be renovating the center block where the House of Commons sits, this is pretty good time to also take a few minutes and install electronic voting.
Then there are a few more in this section, administrative type suggestions, things like examining different ways of scheduling debates on motions, which are things that could just help it flow better. Or I think this is where some of the opposition skepticism could come in, is if the idea of, well, maybe we can just tweak the calendar a little, if that suddenly means there are fewer opposition days or there are less opportunities to put forward motions, it could tie the hands of the opposition a little bit. There aren't enough details in here to really know which way I think they're going, and the report itself seems to suggest that it'll apply equally to the government as well as opposition. And on the other hand, there's also a good section about really opening it up for more private members' business and making sure that all of the bills being passed aren't just government bills, but that backbenchers have a purpose in Parliament besides just being yes men and women. So enabling private members' business to be able to move forward a little bit smoother would probably be a very welcome change.
Two other proposed changes are altering time allocation and prorogation. Time allocation has been used to basically short-circuit debate and move right on to the voting stage in Parliament. And the report proposes an alternative method to schedule and allocate time within the House for debate. Specifically, they cite the UK model of programming, where during second reading, the government introduces a motion basically outlining how the debate is going to be structured going forward and setting out a specific amount of time for this measure and bill to be debated. And it allows less kind of playing around with it because it's set out ahead of time. And similarly, their proposed changes to prorogation basically follow a similar model where they outline at the start of the legislative session, these are the situations in which we would prorogue Parliament, you know, gets approved by the legislature, and then they're kind of stuck with that, so they can't make a change at the end of the session, or middle of the session, when they want to suddenly dissolve Parliament to avoid, say, dealing with a particular political scandal.
Yeah, both of these are definitely direct responses to the Harper government. These were things that were in the Liberals' platform. I think a lot of these proposals were sort of buried in the weeds. The idea of making sure prorogation follows a certain set of rules is very attractive. It's a tool that is important for governments. They want to be able to sort of hit that hard reset button on their legislative agenda. And it's always a bit weird to me that it kills all of their own bills. But I guess sometimes you go, guess we didn't actually like those ones. But there are reasons that they'd want to do it. And so having to set that out either in advance or make it a much more formal event where it's not just, oh, we went and asked and suddenly Parliament's dissolved until things have calmed down. Similarly with time allocation, I think it had a noble intention when it was first brought in, but it has basically ended up just being another version of closure, which is just, all right, time's up, time to vote. So these alternatives it's proposing, either looking at the British model, or they even talk about the sort of New Zealand or US House of Representatives having essentially the similar idea of setting out how many days we're going to consider this bill. It gives everyone a nice calendar to say, all right, we're going to look at this for this time. If we want to get it through, we have to do that. The risk is if that then says, all right, it's got 4 days, we just have to filibuster for 4 days if we don't want the bill to pass. But that's why they sort of look at a more made in Canada scheme and trying to figure out what do you do to make sure that the opposition gets its voice in, but also can't obstruct a bill that would have a majority support. Another proposal that I'm actually pretty interested in seeing is the idea of bringing a Prime Minister's question period to Canada. This is something they do in Britain, and the Prime Minister, him or herself, has to be in Parliament responding directly to oral questions from members of the House. We sort of had that as an ideal in Canada, but generally there's just questions for the government. And so question period could be asking the Minister of International Relations or the Minister of Indigenous Affairs, or you're asking a minister and they may even direct it to a parliamentary secretary or another minister, or they may not even be in the country and someone else is answering. A lot of the times the Prime Minister's not even in the room for question period, even though it's the sort of flashy big event of the parliamentary calendar.
Yeah, no, I also think this is a good idea as well, and, you know, long overdue, but it would also need to be paired with a few other reforms, such as by being able to direct a question at someone and have them answer, you avoid the situation of, you know, having someone like Paul Calandra just stand up in their stead and, you know, recite the most inane talking points.
Yeah, the hope is to make for meaningful questions and meaningful answers. They actually are a little bit thin on details of how to make that happen, because you can't, like, force the government to actually answer questions.
As the saying goes, it's called question period, not answer period.
They do talk about giving longer time, so hopefully that would allow more detailed responses to come through. But
I think you're just going to get longer, more named talking points in that case, and ultimately, it's very hard to get a system where you can force an answer unless you want the speaker having a rule on everything. And that's the more you push them into the position of having to decide what is and isn't a good enough answer, I think further politicizes, which is an office which is notionally apolitical.
The flip side of this coin is the written questions, which often require answers that are much more detailed and and need staffers to go dig through government data and come up with a detailed response, maybe about like how much it costs to build a bunch of bridges in a riding or something. It's not very exciting stuff, but it makes up for a lot of good information for MPs, for their constituents, or for political parties to sort of start to position around. I know the Conservatives use this a lot to sort of expose the Liberals' fundraising scandals.
Yeah, this is sort of the MP's version of the Freedom of Information Act, where they get a probe government departments for information.
The one issue with it right now, though, is as government gets more and more complicated, getting these answers back, in their claim, is taking longer and longer. So they're trying to look at how can we make the time limit, which right now is 45 days, a bit more flexible. So if there is a lot of data to prepare, there's a way to make sure it's through. This could be a weasel out, though, of kicking the issue down the road so that you don't actually have to deal with it. One thing we've seen in BC is a lot of FOI requests get delayed or come in very late.
Yeah, I'd also be somewhat hesitant on this one as well, at least if it's broadly applied versus narrowly tailored to complex questions, where there needs to be an exemption for that standard time limit to apply. And, you know, the ministry in question would have to, you know, make the case somehow on that, rather than just give a blanket everything gets now 60 some odd days for a response.
They'll just give every response in between Christmas and New Year, so no one actually notices or pays attention. Another proposal, which arguably is directly going after one of the infamous tactics of the Harper government, is to end, quote, the improper use of omnibus legislation. This is when you put several different bills into one big package, maybe hundreds of pages long, and then sort of rush it through Parliament, because then you can just approve your entire legislative agenda in Bill 5, say, or whatever. This becomes a problem when there are very good measures in there, but also very problematic and things that require more scrutiny. But it becomes a take-it-or-leave-it approach. And this happens a lot in the States, especially, where there are always these little tack-ons that you go, well, I got this thing I want, but now I had to accept some loosening of firearms. The way they propose to deal with this is giving the Speaker authority to essentially crack apart bills if he or she deems them not meeting a sort of unified theme. This is already allowed for the clerk to look at written questions and break them up into different questions if there's too much information being asked for that doesn't really all match, and says, no, this is actually five different questions because it needs to go to five different departments. It's hard to say if this is a good use of the Speaker's ability or if this is one of those things, like you say, could get politicized. It's tough because there are times you want to put through a couple bills together. Like, the government right now is trying to clean up parts of the criminal code, and you'll put lots of lines in there of, we're going to get rid of these eight provisions. And you could argue that getting rid of each provision of the criminal code that's either out of date or questionable should be debated on its own merits. Or maybe we can just sweep them all together.
Yeah, well, for that example, I think it depends what provisions you're talking about. If it's the ones that have been voided by the courts and ruled unconstitutional, throw them into one omnibus bill and just get it over with. If it's the ones that, you know, are not really enforced or used anymore, but are still on the books and in theory enforceable, then yeah, I think you would need to break it apart and debate each one separately.
So we'll need the anti-blasphemy law, we'll need the anti-witchcraft law, and
The anti-fraudulent witchcraft law, because apparently that is the key distinction in our criminal code.
And the final section of this report gets into cleaning up committees, because committees are a valuable part of our parliamentary process. It's how a smaller group of MPs can really study a bill, have some witnesses, and try to improve bills before they could become laws. In the previous government, many of the committees often became hyper-partisan cesspools that weren't known for their particular well-functioning ethos. It's hard to say how exactly you fix that, but the government is currently looking at trying to just essentially give a bit more independence to the members on a committee, maybe limiting speeches on certain parts. So instead of letting people ramble on and filibuster a committee, put 10-minute caps on some of the specific speeches, and maybe take the parliamentary secretary's role back a little bit. Still have the government involved in committees, but not in a sort of dictatorial style. Some of this, especially I imagine the speech limits, will be seen as an attack on the opposition, because they'll want the right to speak as long and passionately as they want about a bill they care deeply about. But it's always that tough balance. And so, or after hearing what happened in some committees in the previous parliaments, change is needed. But overall, Conservative and NDP MPs were quick to come out against this proposal. They talked in very stark terms about how this will limit debate and shut down opportunities to hold the government to account. And they just express a lot of concern. And I wonder almost if they jump the horse a little, like some of these, and perhaps they're fine with like the electronic voting and the omnibus breaking up. But this does seem very different in my mind than Motion 6 from early last year.
Yeah, although it didn't stop NDP House Leader Murray Rankin from suggesting that not only is this a follow-up, but appears to go even further. Yeah, in terms of declawing the opposition's ability to resist the will of the Liberal majority, which I think is a tad hyperbolic, as we've just discussed. You know, there's a few things that might shift the balance slightly in the government's favor, but at the same time, there's a few things that also make MPs a little more independent. I mean, not as independent as I'd like, and you're not likely to see a significant scaling back to the very heavy party discipline that exists in our federal parliament.
A lot of the changes they're suggesting in this position paper are essentially meant to feed into the work of the House Committee on Procedure and House Affairs, which is basically the group that tries to figure out what the rules of play are. And they're studying and looking at how to make all these changes, but they have a sort of limited scope. So a lot of the bigger problems with the partisanship in our parliament come from things that Michael Chong has looked at in terms of how do we limit the power of the party leader over individual MPs, things like signing nomination papers and those kind of sticks.
Committee memberships as well is another big one.
Exactly, and those are sort of outside the scope of what we can solve with tinkering with the procedures of parliament. There's a lot of important stuff in here, but it's only a few pieces of the puzzle, I guess. So it'll be interesting to see going forward which of these proposals make it through the next stages and whether longer term this will help parliament just function a little bit better and maybe restore people's confidence in it. I know people like to slag off how partisan and how rancorous and disrespectful the tone is in parliament. I don't know that this will solve all of that, but hopefully some of the better ideas will make it through and just make for a slightly healthier democracy.
Moving on to segment two, doing nothing is something. The BC Liberal government has put forward their proposals to deal with the recent scandal over political donations. And as we expected, they have introduced a requirement for real-time donation disclosures. This is part of the bill they have put forward before the legislature. In addition to that, they're also proposing an independent panel that will review the campaign finance laws. Now, this independent panel isn't going to be in place until after the election, so in terms of getting something before the election, actually having some level of accountability on this is basically non-existent.
Well, and then the panel is only tasked with making recommendations, of which the government can just completely ignore, as often happens with committee reports and research recommendations. So we're looking at a panel that might meet in May, June, July, maybe the end of the year, and then every 8 years thereafter. And it'll likely tell us what we already know, which is that people from outside the province probably shouldn't be donating to political parties in the province, that corporations and unions should probably have at least some limits on them, if not full bans, like most provinces have brought in the federal government. and that individuals should have some kind of cap at some point. It could be a very large cap, or it could go down to some of the smaller caps that we've seen in other provinces. But it's really kicking that can as far down the path as possible. The thing we predicted, which was that the Liberals would basically put rules in place to match exactly what they're already doing, is exactly what happened. They've been really proud over the last few weeks about how they're putting their donations up as fast as they can, and much faster than the NDP, who are hiding who their donors are. And I think, as we discussed that last week, that's great, but it's not really the ultimate solution to
this.
Or
even really the key issue here.
Yeah, it's not that important to know who donated yesterday, when literally anyone can be donating. And there's even people donating through shell companies, it seems, or individuals donating on behalf of companies when they shouldn't be. So there's a lot of all of this sketchy activity going on that is sort of ignored by this. Instead, this is almost a penalty on the NDP and Greens, and, well, I guess the Conservatives and any other political parties.
No, if they actually get donations.
Well, yeah. Can you imagine if you're a tiny party, you will have a few donations, but now, in addition to collecting those donations and remembering to issue your correct tax receipts, you also have to publish those donations within 24 or 48 hours. Like, there was an article about the BC Conservatives that we might get to later, and their spokesperson doesn't actually know how much money they have because he, quote, would have to call their treasurer, who probably wouldn't be able to tell him anyway. And that's just what life is like in tiny political parties. And now they're going to have to publish their donations every day.
Yeah, it's especially hard for the ones that don't even have, you know, a full-time staff. You know, if this is the sort of thing you know, someone does on the weekends, is trying to do a little political organize, it suddenly becomes very hard when every day they're now having to go out and, you know, comb through the donations and pull out any information and post on a website.
Well, the Liberals' excuse for not doing anything more came down to a sort of American absolute corporate free speech argument that restrictions on donations might offend the charter. For example, MLA Andrew Wilkinson criticized the NDP and the Greens' attempts through private members' bills to restrict corporate and union donations, saying they're crude instruments.
In fact, not robust enough.
He said they're crude instruments that are legislative in nature, and to pass those would invite charter challenges under Section 2, Freedom of Association and Freedom of Expression. He's essentially arguing that Citizens United is going to happen in Canada, and corporations should just be allowed to donate because that's their free speech, even though these laws exist in Alberta, in the federal government, and in other provinces, and have done for quite a while in some of those cases, and we haven't seen, or at least I haven't heard of any charter challenges to them that have won, at least.
Yeah, I believe there have been some lawsuits over this, and none of them have succeeded. As I recall, all of the campaign finance laws that restrict such donations fall under Sections 1, Reasonable Limits Clause.
What's even better about this angle of the story, though, is Guy Giorno, who was chief of staff to Mike Harris and Stephen Harper, not exactly anti-corporate governments, to say the least, definitely on the sort of free speech and libertarian side of the conservative end. He's saying these claims are absurd, or he calls them specifically astonishing. You know, he's talking about how there's no precedent for this. Like, governments are allowed to restrict this. And so you have one of Stephen Harper's right-hand people saying you're out to lunch with your legal arguments. He is a lawyer who works on election laws. It's not like he's just some guy. He, I think, knows what he's talking about, at least on this issue.
Yes, and just to push back a little on the characterization of the Conservative, it does not surprise me at all they were happy to. In fact, they dropped the donation limit when they took power back in 2006. They've always been much more of a small regular donations party fundraising operation than the Liberals, who were the real kind of Bay Street favorites before the corporate and union donation ban went in federally.
The BC Liberals have a lot of overlap with the sort of supporters of the federal Conservatives. Our Liberals are sort of the right of center. But now with this proposal, I don't really know who they're hoping to appease other than their own donors. You have critics on the left who were going to be upset with anything you did. You have now critics on the right who are also calling you corrupt and saying, we've brought in real laws and your excuses for not doing any more don't make any sense. What was the point of this bill? She could have like cut the legs out from under the NDP and said, all right, we've already got our war chest. Now we're going to cut off your ability to get yours. The Greens have already said they're not taking corporate union donations. Like, this is just such a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. If anything, this would be the point where they have a significant fundraising advantage over the NDP. It's to, put a hard limit in right before the election, make the issue just go away, and ride that bigger stockpile of campaign resources into the election. I think they're hoping to win and keep on pulling in this sort of money come May.
Well, the problem then becomes if they do win and they have this panel, the panel then becomes the gift that keeps on giving for the opposition.
It's made up of independent members who are appointed by the Deputy Attorney General, so a civil servant position, not a political appointment. And then they have to be approved by all parties in the legislature.
So you'll have reasonable people in theory coming forward, and reasonable people at this point, I have to assume, are going to recommend some kind of new regulations and laws to bring this embarrassment closer to the rest of the political norm as it stands. And does the government then just ignore it again and eat more of the controversy? Or do they finally cave in? Like, what's the point of not doing it now when they're just going to invite the same debate in 3-6 months whenever this panel comes together?
Well, that's the thing. 3 to 6 months from now is the start of a new mandate, and that gives it 4 years for everybody to forget about the recommendations and for them to spend a few months saying, oh yeah, no, we're looking at it, we're thinking about introducing a bill on it, and then, you know, everybody moves on to something else and it just gets forgotten about, and then it doesn't come up for not only till into the next term, the term after that when they meet 8 years later.
Or they totally break their promise and then citizens initiate another referendum, which then distracts from the entire broken promise in the first place, because whether or not they win the referendum, it's then an outlet for that rage. And then things can go back to normal. But otherwise, just a largely missed opportunity for the Christy Clark Liberals. And it comes at a point when their government is at the very real risk of being considered tired and out of ideas. They've been in power for quite a long time, and to come forward with your election reform as, yeah, we're good. Things are good as they are.
Well, I think things are good as they are to basically be Christy Clark's slogan. But yeah, this seems kind of more or less par for the course in terms of her governance style of more or less, you know, keep on going with how things are and make some small change when something gets enough attention they have to make a statement on it.
All right, moving into our third segment, Agree to Agree. The NDP leadership candidates, the first four at least, Ashton, Caron, Angus, and Julian, met in Ottawa for a debate over this past weekend. I haven't actually watched it yet, but by all reports, it was a very agreeable situation where the idea of fighting climate change and fighting inequality were very well supported.
Yeah, I did watch it, and there wasn't a huge amount of policy difference between all the candidates. Kind of more what flavor they wanted to put on it more than anything else. In terms of actually putting forward policy, I think the two standouts were Guy Caron with his basic income and Peter Julian's free tuition promise. We've touched on both of them in previous episodes, but they were definitely, I think, the standouts on the stage there. And I came away actually quite liking what Guy Caron's position is on a lot of stuff. I mean, I disagree with him on a fair bit, but like, he definitely struck me as the policy wonk on the stage there. And I think really hit the point home when he said, not only does the NDP have to have a policy, it needs to be a broad and detailed policy that they need to articulate well, and that was not what they did in 2015.
Caron is a Quebec economist, so he has his mind around numbers and is kind of the perfect person to pitch basic income on a national scale. And by all accounts, he's definitely performing much better than sort of anyone expected, or at least I expected. I didn't really know who he was, and now he's starting to at least get some attention. And I think one of the big problems, and one of the reasons I didn't dive in to make sure I watched this first debate, is the first debates of these leadership contests are always so almost pointless, because all these candidates trickle their policies out over the time of the campaign. So the only time you have an actual policy debate is sort of the last couple debates, when they have their cards on the table and they can compare and see what's up. Right now it's the personality contest entirely.
And that is really kind of what the questions, to a disappointingly large degree, leaned on. We got questions on, you know, what was their favorite beer or sports? What was the last book they read? And, you know, another spot where Caron stood out, sight and Sagan. So that endeared him a bit to me, but I would have rather, you know, done policy rather than asking, you know, whether or not they like, you know, hockey or...
Or what's your favorite sport? And you try to make a joke about door knocking.
But, you know, Nikki Ashton just wasn't funny. Yeah, and then speaking of Nikki Ashton, she... in, I think, rather typical Nikki Ashton fashion, buzzword-heavy answers on everything, but not a huge amount of depth or policy really put forward.
Yeah, she's going for a very strong, almost the Tumblr vote, let's say. The radical leftist caricature that the right wing and even the sort of centrist or moderate lefts like to mock seems to be her core constituency. And that leads to embarrassing situations, like she put out a meme that said, to the left, referencing the Beyoncé song, which then Vancouver's Black Lives Matter said was cultural appropriation, and she promptly apologized and deleted. And I'm not going to wade into who's right. It's kind of embarrassing all around, and I'm going to leave that over there, to the left.
Well, careful, you don't want to appropriate any cultures with that. I did see that as well. I think it was kind of a rather embarrassing moment. It didn't speak well to her leadership approach or how she'd be dealing with touchy issues going forward. You know, it's, I think, fairly arguable whether a pop culture icon as significant and, you know, broadly ingrained in the general zeitgeist of Western culture as Beyoncé is really cultural appropriation, especially when it turns out that like half the songwriters were Norwegian or something on there too, which the point is that it's definitely one of those areas where I think respectful disagreement could happen, and there wasn't even a sign of that. It was more just kind of the, you know, throw the right buzzwords at, and, you know, Nikki Ashton will cave is kind of what it came across as, whether or not that's justifiable or not, but I don't think it spoke well to kind of the leadership aspect on it, where you can kind of have a principal disagreement with your constituents or other interested parties.
At least on a personal level, I do prefer this to like questions about whether Maxime Bernier's red pill analogies were knowingly misogynistic or just like someone was hinting at it.
Well, to be fair to Maxime Bernier on this one, between, you know, major movie franchise which everybody knows and a Reddit community of a couple thousand, 10,000 some odd people, it's most likely some 50-year-old guy from Quebec is referencing the movie, not the other one.
Oh, I just mean that I prefer debate over whether or not it's cultural appropriation to whether or not a major political party candidate or his staff, let's say, are trying to make a subtle appeal to the misogynistic alt-right. But neither are that endearing to the Canadian political discourse, let's say.
I think both debates have overall lowered the general tenure of, well, both leadership.
So there's going to be more debates, and hopefully as those progress, we'll learn more details about these candidates rather than just the sort of buzzwords or what sports they like and what beers they like. I've learned since we talked about the leadership last that there will be a Vancouver debate. later in the summer, I believe. And hopefully either myself or both of us can be there and we'll have some comments on what we see live. It might be a bigger field by the time we get there. We've talked in the past about Jagmeet Singh and Sid Ryan, who are both still considering their bids. But there's a new name in the field who's not actually an NDP member or even a politician, but he's attracted a little bit of attention. Pat Stogran is the former Veteran Affairs Ombudsman who has criticized both the Liberals and Tories as out-of-touch elites, which is a perfect tagline at home in the NDP, Liberal, Tory, same old story. But he presents a very interesting, unique perspective because, as far as I can tell, he's very widely respected for his work on Veteran Affairs and actually comes from a military background. So something you don't often see a lot in the NDP is that sort of connection with the armed forces. So this could potentially be a very good benefit for him, broadening the tent of the NDP to people who usually consider them too soft on foreign policy, for example.
Yeah, and that is one area I think the NDP could really improve on a bit is their foreign policy and defense policy. Reading their platforms in the last couple of elections, it does not appear to be an area they've given great consideration to. Just, for example, in the 2015 election, they were seriously proposing changing the universality of service requirement in the military, which, for those who don't know, it's basically can be summarized as soldier first. Like, everybody has to be able to do the basic functions of an infantryman in order to be in the military. And that makes perfect sense, because everybody in the military needs to be deployable. And, you know, if something happens, everyone needs to be able to pick up a rifle and fight. And they were looking at scaling that back. I think it was in response to somebody getting discharged over disability or an injury or something. But the fact that they were seriously looking at that, and it was a policy that would seriously undermine the ability of the forces to carry out its missions, suggests a party that has not seriously looked at the issue.
Well, and then there's another potential candidate, or at least someone who really wanted to be a candidate. Brian Graff is formerly in real estate, but I guess has been unemployed for a while, according to the Globe and Mail.
Which is a little odd in a market as hot as Toronto.
He joined the NDP about 7 months ago, and he started filling out the paperwork to run for the leadership because he's got ideas, I guess. Only the party leadership denied his application. I guess it was actually the first time the NDP has ever denied anyone the request to lead the NDP. And maybe that's because the NDP is so open, or maybe that's just because the NDP's never really attracted enough people to run for its leadership. He did appeal that decision and was also denied, and he was never really given an answer of why by the NDP, according to him. So now he's filing for judicial review, saying it was unfair, and he just wants to make sure it's an open democratic race, as the NDP's values are.
He does kind of have a point in that the criteria for leadership should be clear, and that, you know, any denial should have at the very least an explanation why included in it. But at the same time, I can't imagine anyone suing their way into a leadership race is going to do well with it. And by and large, people agree parties should be able to set the terms of their own races. It's just a question of should those terms also be, you know, generally available to everyone.
Yeah, by Graf's own admission, he's not really sure he can get the 500 signatures he needs or raise the $30,000 he needs to enter the race. So it almost sounds like the NDP leadership is trying to do him a favor, like saying, no, you're better off not trying. Like, you're not going to win. You're probably not even going to get in, so you should just save your time. Do everyone a favor and just don't. Which, again, is not the democratic spirit of the leadership race, which should be accessible to everyone who wants to give it an honest go. But we'll see. Maybe this will expose a flaw in the way they set up the constitution and the process by which they're approving candidates. Or maybe it'll be something that Graff just runs out of money and can't keep up his court challenge and just gives up.
One possible reason he may have been denied is that he has two court cases on the go currently before this one. So the party may have decided that someone with such an active legal situation may not be the best person to put forward, especially considering those court cases are related to politics. Specifically, he's suing Toronto City Councillor Michael Thompson and Mary Margaret McMahon, as well as he has a lawsuit over a column about the 2014 municipal election. So someone who's kind of that lawsuit happy over political issues might be the sort of thing a party wouldn't want to associate themselves with.
Yeah, in the last election, there was a stream of stories out of almost every party of candidates with embarrassing social media presences. The current crop of leadership candidates are obviously decently polished politicians, so we're not too worried about scandalous Charlie Angus punk rock photos coming out. But at this level, where you have potentially litigious candidate who's now suing your party, maybe there's reason to be skeptical.
Yeah, it's just too bad the NDP kind of didn't diffuse it a bit by just releasing the reason why.
Yeah. All right, well, moving into our quick takes. First up, we've learned that the BC Conservatives will not be in the televised leaders debate this year, but the Green Party will. The consortium that sets the rules of the leaders debate has essentially put out three criteria, of which your political party must meet two to be considered legitimate enough to debate. You have to either be running candidates in 73 ridings, which is 90% of the province, receive at least 10% of the popular vote in the last election, or have at least one seat in the legislature. And it's clear the Liberals and NDP meet all three of those. I think even the Green Party's pretty close. They might not have them all nominated yet, but I think that's their goal, is to be pretty close to a full slate. The Conservatives are looking at nominating about 40 people this time, so even if their party sweeps every riding they run in, they will not form a majority government. I'm not entirely sure they even got 10% in the last election, and they don't have a seat in the legislature, so they don't meet any of the bars. Of course, even if the Conservatives had met the right bars, they don't have a leader in place, so they'd still have to find a sort of interim spokesperson. And one possibility might be communications and policy director John Twigg, who spoke with the Globe and Mail quite extensively about the captivating, in his words, policy ideas that are going to be unveiled. He did say they're not going to whine about being excluded, but we're disappointed they can't leave the door open a crack. I don't know what that means. Like, he could stand in the corner looking at the debate?
I think it means if they, you know, were to have a stellar campaign and suddenly be polling at 30 or 40%, they wouldn't be allowed in.
I like Twigg's comments later in this article, though, where I guess the Globe did a sort of piece like we did and looked at their website and got a little confused. And the Globe and Mail notes that there are videos about climate change on the party's website, not noting they're mostly denialist videos. But Twigg said he's not actually familiar with them. Let's just drive this home. The communications director doesn't know what's on their website. He says they may be boilerplate that's been up there for a while. And he goes on like that about how they're a movement. He talks, as I mentioned earlier, about not knowing what their party's war chest is, and their treasurer probably wouldn't even tell him if he called. But they probably don't have much money. So they're in about as bad shape as we assessed a couple weeks ago, it looks like.
It's surprisingly polling at 13%.
There's still time.
In other BC election news, the BC NDP has put forward a tech strategy. Of particular note in here is they are proposing to significantly increase the amount of government IT contracts going towards BC firms, which not only strikes me as a bad idea policy-wise, it's the sort of protectionist ideas that really should have gone out a long time ago. But not only that, there's also the issues of NAFTA and CETA, which will soon be law, where governments at the provincial level can't discriminate against firms from outside of their jurisdiction.
A big part of the announcement they did beyond the sort of procurement is $100 million to go into post-secondary education training programs in technology, as well as creating a chief talent officer to really just look at developing industry talent and just making it easier for local companies to access government technologies. Basically, doing the sort of other side where you help the IT industry thrive. BC does have a growing IT field.
In fact, Vancouver is actually just rated as one of the top cities for startups.
Just in Vancouver, we birthed Hootsuite and Slack, which are platforms I use quite a bit for different purposes. So there's an argument to be made that the government should at least do what it can to build alliances and support these industries where it still meets its trade obligations. But it does show that I think they're trying to position themselves in favor of BC jobs. And so then they can start to position the BC Liberals as the export the jobs. And here's, I think, they're trying to look at high tech, and this is their way to approach that.
Of course, one of the scandals that still kind of hangs over the NDP's head is a case where they tried to do the jobs here in BC, and the whole project ended up going wildly off the rails, and we had the Fast Ferries debacle as a result. So one hopes that a problem from their past that long ago has kind of faded away, but it is something that's oddly enough still seems to resonate a bit in BC. So we'll see how that manages to play out.
Well, speaking of shadows of the NDP past, former BC NDP Premier Mike Harcourt and former Vancouver Mayor Mike Harcourt was in Vancouver talking with current Mayor Gregor Robertson about transit. And Harcourt really doubled down on the need to build a Broadway subway line all the way to UBC. None of this get to Arbutus. He wants to see TransLink go big and fast so that we can encourage greater density and support the density that's going to come along this corridor. These are welcome comments that I can't disagree with.
Yeah, I also like the suggestion. Not only is the current transit infrastructure on the corridor over capacity and in dire need of an upgrade, but eventually it is going to have to be extended out to UBC. So the proposal that's kind of floating around right now of only building the line out to Arbutus, it's just end up going to cost more money in the long run to have to do it in two phases. It would be better to do it now on one contract, you know, just spend a little more time and money building it all out at once rather than coming back to it in 10 years and have to haggle over the money once again. In other news, in follow-up to an item we covered 2 weeks ago where the mayor of North Vancouver proposed a tunnel under the Burrard Inlet and the harbor over to the North Shore for a rapid transit line. Another proposal has been put forward to use a gondola system to span the harbor. This would be a near record setting gondola span, roughly equivalent to the Peak to Peak that is currently operating between Whistler and Blackcomb. Of course, that one has the advantage of being fairly high up on a mountain, so when it dips down from the cable side, it doesn't have that chance to interfere with anything going on below. So there would be some technical challenges. But in theory, it would be both significantly cheaper at less than $100 million, as well as, in theory, it's also able to have a higher throughput on the system than the current C-Bus.
In England, they have a Emirates airline that is a cable car that goes from Greenwich to the city and sort of East London, and it crosses the Thames, but it's only just over a kilometer long. And while it was introduced for the Olympics and was a big tourist draw at that point, it's not really been that successful as a part of the London transit infrastructure. It feels like one of those big Boris Johnson crazy ideas that then became reality and is now kind of an eyesore. It's like a monorail type solution that you just go, oh, why did they do that? Part of the problem there is it goes not between the best two hubs of London, but downtown to North Vancouver has a lot of commuter traffic, so maybe there's a better case for it. The 7 kilometer span is still something that would be a technological marvel to accomplish, and that alone would be cool as long as it doesn't block the path of landing seaplanes. But I don't see it happening. I see much sooner a gondola going up SFU in Burnaby from the base of the production way SkyTrain up to the top, where often buses are getting stuck and spun out in the winter. And they have done legitimate studies of that, and it seems like a much more realistic gondola to build.
And gondolas have been used fairly effectively in other cities, but they've primarily been mountainous ones in places like Bolivia and Colombia, where the more traditional transit infrastructure doesn't work so well. And the SFU one's been kind of kicked around for quite a while now, and may end up happening, but I think it's probably not going to be the solution people settle on. Even if the tunnel's going to be an order of magnitude more expensive, it does have some benefits of not interfering with the port in quite the same way, and also allows further expansion of the same rapid transit line throughout the North Shore, rather than having to switch modes at stations on each side of the harbor.
Well, speaking of radical transit options, Nova Scotia might be getting a rocket launch site in the next year. Commercial firm is looking at a number of potential launch sites around North America and selected Nova Scotia, of all places, as its ideal port to send payloads to the stars.
Which just seems really odd, because the latitude that Nova Scotia is at is not the best place to economically launch a rocket from. You know, you want to be as close to the equator as possible, which not only basically rules out most of Canada, but like they even selected kind of the northern part of mainland Nova Scotia for this. It wasn't even down by Yarmouth, where arguably you get a little bit of that gain by going a little more south.
My favorite part of this whole story, though, is that the company promises they won't launch during lobster season. They want to make sure they're environmentally sensitive, of course. I guess that includes making sure that when Nova Scotians are out catching lobsters, as they do, that rockets aren't disrupting the entire area. It would mean a lot of jobs for Nova Scotia, a lot of high-tech, well-paying construction and then operating jobs, and be a kind of tourist draw, I guess, for Eastern Canada. Not that it needs a rocket launch pad. I've heard it's very nice, but it's a cool idea.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this goes, but I'm just having a hard time understanding the economics of putting a launch site in Nova Scotia. Basically, nowhere in Canada really makes all that much sense to launch rockets from. And I suppose the East Coast is better than Central Canada, because you aren't going to be dropping any rocket failures onto people, but it's still just really weird. We better try and find somewhere further south. Florida, or Texas, or some Caribbean island or something. The European Space Agency sends their rockets all the way to South America to launch just for this reason, and wouldn't be that hard to rent a few hundred acres somewhere to set up a rocket launch facility, or hell, even the idea that gets tossed around like once a decade of having the Turks and Caicos Islands join Canada. Strategically, it would make a lot more sense to do that if you're trying to like bootstrap a space industry than it does to set up a rocket launch pad in Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia's not even close to a lot of other industry that you would use to support a space program. If you're going to be launching things into space, you kind of want to be near production facilities, other manufacturing companies, and just the central hubs. So like you're mentioning, Florida and Texas make a bit more sense. At least they're very well connected. Nova Scotia is kind of like the edge of Canada in some ways. It's just remote. And it's one thing to be ferrying your cargo to the Caribbean when you have the economics of being at the equator to make launching easier, but taking it to Nova Scotia is just a bit weird.
Not only that, remote Nova Scotia. This is apparently the place that takes a while to get to from Halifax, which is already kind of way out at one end of the country and away from kind of the manufacturing hub of the Central Canada, Quebec, and Ontario. A more local news, the Vision Vancouver, one of the political parties and the one that's in power right now in Vancouver, has launched a new campaign Stand Up for Renters, which is basically a campaign to pester your MLA about making changes to the Tenancy Act. It's aimed at stopping rent evictions, where the building gets torn down or renovated and the tenants get evicted as part of the process. And in theory, that's something that should definitely be addressed. But my big question on this is, why isn't Vision Vancouver using the powers of the city to try and get as much action on this rather than doing what they've done a lot of housing issues and punting it to the province?
I think the city's at times has its hands very tied in terms of what it can do. The Vancouver Charter puts it in a unique situation compared to even neighboring municipalities, which are governed by entirely different legislation. A lot of the powers around tenancy are at the provincial level as well in Canada. We don't have municipal abilities to put rent controls in if that's what they want, or even just generally set how leases are controlled. So it does make sense for them to really highlight that if they're getting a lot of calls about, oh, how do I get out of this lease or whatever, maybe they just don't want to answer those questions anymore and they just want to say, look, we've done all we can on these questions. You need to talk to your MLA, most of who in Vancouver I think are pretty sympathetic. Most of the MLAs of the city of Vancouver are NDP and generally are more pro-reform to the tenancy agreements, at least in terms of favoring tenants.
Vancouver definitely has some limits on what it can do, but at the same time, like, they will be issuing building permits for the work that's being done that these tenants are being evicted for. Maybe they should be looking at conditioning the approval of these building permits on how they treat the people they're evicting. Like, there's options here they could be looking at and just go into the province and yet again complaining about the housing situation maybe isn't what they should be doing versus trying to use the tools at their disposal at the city level to try and solve this as well.
Well, I think the timing gives it away. It's clearly put tenancy and renters' rights on the election agenda as part of the broader discussion about housing issues. Hopefully they will look to do more that is within their own purview after the election, but maybe now is the chance they have to get some provincial solutions to these.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politicos Pod. Also, check out the Dark Horse Report at thedarkhorse.report. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.